A young Marine returns from war to his hometown in western Pennsylvania. He becomes a high school teacher. He marries the young woman who waited for him while he was in the service. They buy a house, think about starting a family, and they invite her widowed mother to come and live with them. 1 year later, the dead body of his mother-in-law lies sprawled on the kitchen floor. The body of his wife is in the living room, perforated with bullets. The former Marine is taken away by the sheriff. The local newspapers are filled with testimony from the man's former employer, neighbors, and students, all tributes to the good worker and teacher and neighbor that they knew Donald Watkins to be. It seems like a story from last week's news, but the year was 1948. After more than 30 years of confinement, Donald Watkins returned to his hometown in western Pennsylvania. And then he married my mother. He was 78, and she was a younger woman of 70. My mother told me Donald's story, and though he rarely spoke of it, Donald's story haunted me, and I decided that I needed to know more about him and what happened. In September 2000, 4 years after Donald's death, I placed ads in the Marine Gazette and the Leatherneck, two pretty hardcore military magazines, surprising my mailman who was used to delivering Vogue and InStyle to my house. I was looking for family members of former Marines who served in China between 1937 and 1940. And the first day that my ad appeared, my answering machine at home flashed that I had 7 messages, which seemed like a lot. So I grabbed a pen to start writing down messages. But when I heard the first voice, I could not write at all. It said, "This is Staff Sergeant Clifford Wells. I served in China, 1938, and departed Shanghai on the USS Truman, 23 March, 1940. I usually bowl on Mondays and Wednesdays, so it's best to call me on Friday." All of the messages were delivered in these clipped tones. The callers recited rank, name, duty assignment, location in China, and they all included the exact date of arrival and departure. I received calls and letters and emails, too, from engineer, corpsman, a chef for the enlisted men, and even the chauffeur for the commander. These men, Marines, were then in their late 80s. "I'm happy to help you," one wrote, "but please don't call me. I'm extremely deaf." These Marines became my teachers. They told me what it was like to be young and far from home, and to see death all around them, and then to have to kill. One of my frequent correspondents was Frenchie DuPont from Louisiana. Frenchie's letters arrived every 2 weeks, and in one letter, which I go back to often, he answered a question that I kept asking. Why hadn't he suffered shell shock in China and later as a prisoner of war in Palawan, in a prison camp? I'd learned his story over a long period of time, and he had been starved, beaten, set on fire, and nearly blinded before he turned 25 years old. "I was so happy to be rescued," he wrote, "that this was never a problem." But that wasn't true for all of his friends. "A lot of the guys still go to the VA every week for some counseling," he said. That is, he meant, 47 years later. At the start of American sporting events, we stand up to sing the national anthem. It is, especially for parents, a teaching moment. At a game, a parent might snatch a hat off a youngster or glower at a teenager who is texting at that time, "Get on your feet, get on your feet." And they do. For many sporting events, there is now another requisite moment during the game, halftime, where we enjoy a tribute to our service men and women serving overseas. And then a soldier in full dress with excellent posture comes onto the field. And for that moment, we pause again. We feel virtuous and patriotic. And we mean it. We really do. For anywhere from 10 to maybe 60 seconds, we really care about the men and women of our military. And then, satisfied that we've cared, and as the soldier so beautifully decorated is escorted out of sight, we return to debating about our favorite teams and the beer commercials. The soldiers that we see at sporting events are clean and composed, and they exude the strength and will and endurance that we have come to expect. The conceit is that they are there to remind us of the hardship that they have endured for us. But in fact, I wonder if they are there to cajole us into believing that the respect that we feel is enough. Our soldiers are dying. They are dying the way that soldiers have always died, killed in combat, wartime accidents. But they are also increasingly dying at home, by their own hand, from addiction, from traumatic brain injury, and from the slow death of persistent mental illness. That is what we don't see, don't honor, and don't stand up for. But what if, during the Super Bowl or the World Series, we saw a group of American soldiers twitching with the physical and mental pain of post-combat fatigue and stress and disability? Not the heroic amputee, we know that symbol of sacrifice, but instead the one whose hope and sanity and peace have been cut off. What if we stood for 60 seconds to witness grown men and women who serve and protect us while they shake and cry and go numb? What if we saw them as they struggle to manage their depression and anxiety and dissociation? But the men who taught me about post-traumatic stress disorder were not from Iraq or Afghanistan. My guys were Marines in China in the 1930s. These were young men. They were in their 20s. They had escaped the Great Depression to serve in Shanghai, the Paris of the Orient. But their good fortune turned on them, and they found themselves in some of the most horrific scenes of war ever recorded. These men, the China Marines, were the witnesses to the rape of Nanking. We were not at war. They were there to stand and protect American civilians, American business interests, but they could not intervene. A terrible internal conflict. They witnessed the Panay incident. Those men know exactly when World War II began. My China Marines gave me quite an education. They explained to me that their official duty in Shanghai was called bombing detail, which sounds serious, but distant. And it was Frenchie DuPont who explained to me, "Now, Diane, every day we had to fill trucks with arms and legs and heads." When they moved from China to the Philippines, their work became hand-to-hand combat. So it was another Marine, Cliff Wells from Los Angeles, who told me how he became a China Marine. It was the Depression. Nobody could get a job. And I thought, this is like Hardy in that poem. Was out of work, had sold his traps, no other reason why. So Cliff and two of his friends went and applied to join the Marines. He was nervous, but when he found out he was accepted, he was pretty excited. He was going to China, foreign and exotic and erotic. Cliff told me about the Mama San houses, where they went every night after work, where they got baths and nice meals with steak, and yes, girls for the soldiers. And it was Cliff who explained hand-to-hand combat. One day we were having lunch in St. Louis at the China Marine reunion, and I had been just using the language I thought I knew something about. And Cliff leaned in and he said, "Do you know what hand-to-hand combat means?" And I knew I was busted, that my ideas about war came from movies. "Diane," he said, "you look at a man who is about to kill you, and you kill him first. You look him in the eyes this close, and then you stab him over and over with your bayonet. And then, because you lived, you do that again and again, maybe all day." I did talk to my guys, my Marines, about Donald. And I was nervous at first. I didn't want them to feel the stigma of a crazy Marine. And I was afraid that they might feel judged by that story. But they didn't. They all just shook their heads. I said, "I think this is about China." And Frenchie said, "Well, of course it is." But another thing that I came to understand were the economics of war. And we've touched on World War I today. On April 6, 1917, U.S. Congress declared war, and we entered World War I. The first full-scale entry into armed conflict on European soil. War has changed since then, and we have changed, and technology has certainly changed, but there is one constant: the psychological injuries sustained by soldiers in war. Various authorities estimate that stress casualties, the first euphemism, are between 40 and 60%. That the words we use have changed over time. And some of the terms include these: battle fatigue, war neurosis, shell shock, military hysteria, trench suicide, and the saddest of all, LMF, which stands for lacking moral fiber. The labels reflect the cultural attitudes of each time and each war, but they are also influenced by economics and demographics. In 1917, the U.S. population was at an all-time high. So in economic terms, supply meant demand. We had enough young men. We had enough bodies and soldiers. So it was not uncommon to find that a soldier who broke down, who froze on the field, who retreated, who refused to fight, or exhibited any detrimental behavior, were considered to have a problem of character rather than an injury, and court-martial could occur immediately, often in the field. By contrast, in World War II, when we began to fight in both Europe and in the East, the U.S. put more than 16 million Americans in uniform, and we did not have the supply to meet demand. So the condition of a struggling soldier had to be framed very differently. We could not court-martial. We could not execute in the field. So war trauma became an illness, which then had to be treated and cured. And the closer that treatment was to the front, the faster the soldier could be returned. And that became one of the strategies. But sometimes when I'm talking about this and I find myself, it feels like I'm saying them and not us. But it's important to know that we have been the beneficiaries of all of this, civilian beneficiaries. There has always been a civilian hand-me-down from psychiatric casualty of war. Our need to keep soldiers on the battlefield in World War II saw the United States' largest investment in psychology and psychiatry. Throughout the 1940s, the Pentagon spent billions of dollars for psychological research, and that has had a lasting impact on all of our lives. If you have talked about processing your feelings or your issues, you are a beneficiary of that work. The research for World War II soldiers spilled into the fields of advertising, education, and even design. Listen to these dates and what happened. In 1946, we saw the first National Mental Health Act. In 1948, The Snake Pit, one of the greatest movies, and I highly recommend it. It's a movie about shock treatment and psychoanalysis. It won 7 Academy Awards. Hollywood gave it a tremendous investment, and the public gave that investment back in its participation. To look at that movie now, it's pretty much a documentary and a lay interpretation of trauma, helping people understand how a difficult thing can result in a challenging behavior. And the new science of the time, psychiatry and shock treatment, considered compassionate, were being taught in the movie. 1948. That same year, Psychology Today magazine was launched for the general public. We all began to step in. 1949, the Nobel Prize for Medicine went to Dr. Egas Moniz, who invented the prefrontal lobotomy. He received the Nobel Prize in Medicine. Again, look at that cultural shift. All of our casual talk of processing our feelings, Oprah, Dr. Phil, are rooted in the Pentagon's need for soldiers. But more, and especially for us today, more than any other war, Vietnam redefined our beliefs about mental health. It was 5 years after the fall of Saigon that Vietnam syndrome was identified. And I find that many people, especially young people, don't know that. They have an idea that post-traumatic stress disorder was born in Vietnam. It wasn't. Those veterans were some of the hardest fighting advocates for their mental health and consequently for ours. Vietnam syndrome became post-Vietnam syndrome, became post-traumatic stress disorder, now post-traumatic stress injury, and it generalized very rapidly to civilians who have suffered any kind of trauma. Again, it's language we throw around. We're very familiar with that. But for now, we have to remember, how will we factor these injuries when we talk about the cost of war? How do we now label our broken soldiers and care for them and their families? It is for these men and women that we should be holding our hands over our hearts. Every faith has a tenet that asks us not to close our eyes to suffering and this kind of suffering. And here too, we should not look away.